Welcome to Cool Stuff Ride Home, Marcus Path, as always, joined by Reggie Rizzou. On today's episode, the incredible memory of mountain chickadees, plus NASA soliciting help to bring Mars samples back to Earth faster and cheaper, and on this day in history, the first solar cell is unveiled. That's coming up on Cool Stuff. Well, I don't know about you, Reg, but I'm one of those people who can never seem to remember where I left my car keys or my money clip, and I'm constantly tearing up the house trying to find these things in frustration. Drives my wife nuts. If only I put them back in the same place every time. Or if only I had the memory of a mountain chickadee. Yes. Chickadees, not elephants in this case. Per a story from the Good News Network, these half-ounce birds with brains slightly larger than a pea stash tens of thousands of food items throughout their lives for safekeeping. Think about squirrels who regularly do the same thing. The chickadees will hide things like seeds and tree bark under dead leaves and inside pine cones all across the mountains. And the crazy part of it is, they can remember their locations with incredible accuracy. When the winter arrives, they'll consult that amazing memory or order to locate food, a skill that helps them survive the bitter cold and deep snow of their homes in Colorado's Rocky Mountains. Now, a new study published April 17th in the journal Current Biology saw researchers at the University of Colorado and the University of Nevada, Reno, identify nearly 100 genes associated with the bird's spatial memory or ability to recall the locations of objects. The paper suggests a potential trade-off may exist between having a solid long-term memory and being able to quickly ditch old memories to form new ones. One clue was how many of these genes result in disorders in other animals. Per Scott Taylor, the director of CU Boulder's Mountain Research Station, quote, "Chickadees are impressive birds. Their spatial memory is much more developed than many other birds that don't have to have this strategy to survive cold winters," end quote. So to evaluate the bird's spatial memory, Taylor's research partners at Nevada, Reno designed a test hanging multiple feeder arrays with seeds in the mountains, each with 8 bird feeders. Each feeder had a gate with a radio frequency reader to detect the unique tags researchers had previously placed on the chickadees. The team then programmed each gate to open only to certain individuals, so the birds had to remember which locations had feeders that would open for them. The team then counted how many times each chickadee landed on the wrong feeders before they recalled the right one, the theory being that birds with better spatial memory would have a lower error rate. Using blood samples, the team in Colorado also sequenced the entire genome of 162 tagged chickadees, creating the largest data set ever collected for evaluating the genetic basis of chickadee cognitive ability. By comparing the birds' genomes with their performance on the feeder test, the team identified 97 genes associated with chickadees' spatial learning and memory. Birds with specific variants of these genes made fewer wrong attempts before landing on their designated feeders, the ones that would open for them. Per the paper's co-author, Sarah Padula, a large proportion of these variants are associated with neuron formation in the hippocampus, part of the brain that's responsible for learning and memory, much like we humans. Per Georgi Semenov, the paper's lead author, quote, "We found in previous literature that many of these genetic variants in chickadees are associated with behavioral disorders in other animals. This finding can help us better understand animal behaviors in general," end quote. That's a fascinating tidbit there. But here's a bit of a twist, perhaps just as interesting. After running the initial task for a few days, the team assigned new feeders to the birds. To their surprise, chickadees that performed better in the initial test tended to struggle with switching to a new feeder, suggesting they may have a tough time abandoning their original memories and creating new ones. Per Padula, quote, "In a more variable environment, what our collaborators found suggests that chickadees with good long-term memory may have a disadvantage. For example, if there is an unexpected snowstorm, these birds may keep trying to visit caches that have been buried in the snow rather than forgetting them and looking for other caches," end quote. For the last 1 million years, the mountain chickadees and the Rocky Mountains have evolved independent from those in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. The team hopes to investigate whether the two groups of birds have evolved spatial memory in the same way across different geographic regions. The team is also interested in learning if black-capped chickadees, which coexist with mountain chickadees in the Rockies, exhibit different spatial memory skills. They'll continue the feeder experiment at the Mountain Research Station during the upcoming winters to collect more data. So, Reg, I'm a little perturbed to find out that mountain chickadees actually have better memory than I do when it comes to locating the necessities in life.
But to be fair, you won't be looking in the snow for a long time trying to find what you lost because you think it should be there. So, you know, it seems like they have good memories, but maybe not as much recognition of that they should be going elsewhere to look for their food instead of like, I remember it was here. It should be here. I'm going to keep going. So you do have an advantage there.
Well, I don't know. I've definitely had that happen a few times where you're like, I know I put this thing in my bag. Why is it not here? And then I tear up my bag three times and you're going, okay, I've checked every pocket. It's clearly not here.
I was going to say, I guess that's very true. I have like tossed a bag like three or four times knowing that something should be there, thinking this time it's going to be there.
So frustrating. Good on you, mountain chickadee.
And it doesn't seem the same. I don't know why. Maybe I'd get used to it, but like, say I have a memory like an elephant. Doesn't seem to roll off the tongue. I have a memory like a chickadee. I guess chickadee is a little bit more fun to say. It's a fun word to say. Chickadee dee dee dee. Remember yesterday I had
my calls. Oh, great. Your impersonations are back. And that's a cue to move on to the next story.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
NASA is looking to bring back samples from Mars. However, they want to speed up the time frame in which it could happen, so they are looking for assistance. Right now, the project is at a halt until a swifter and more economical approach is found. The plan to bring back Mars soils and rocks has lingered on NASA's agenda for decades, although the slated timeline continued to be pushed back due to escalating expenses. A recent independent assessment said the total cost to bring samples back could be between $8 billion and $11 billion, with an anticipated arrival of 2040, approximately a decade beyond the initial planned schedule. Bill Nelson, NASA administrator, believes the cost and timeline are just too excessive. So he is asking private enterprises and the agency's centers to devise alternate strategies to overhaul the project. Faced with across-the-board budget reductions, he aims to prevent the depletion of resources from other scientific projects to finance Mars Sample Initiative. He recently said, quote, "We want to garner every innovative and novel idea possible." So the plan is here, I guess, that, you know, he doesn't want to take money from other projects to fund this project. So he's trying to find a more efficient way of doing this project. So NASA's rover Perseverance has already collected 24 core samples in tubes since its arrival in 2021 at Mars Jezero Crater, which is an ancient river delta. The goal is to secure over 30 samples to look for any signs of ancient Martian life. The space agency hopes to transport at least a portion of the accumulated samples to Earth by the 2030s, with a budget not exceeding $7 billion. In order to accomplish this feat, they need a spacecraft to go to Mars to retrieve the tubes and then lift off from the planet. Then it must rendezvous with another spacecraft tasked with bringing the samples back to Earth. Nikki Fox, NASA's science mission chief, refused to speculate when the samples might arrive at Earth, given a new program and timeline, or even how many samples might be returned. She said that information will be included in any proposals. Quote, "We never embarked on a launch from another planet, and that's precisely what renders Mars sample return such a daunting and captivating mission," end quote. Scientists are eager to analyze the samples from Mars in their own labs, which would be far superior to the kind of rudimentary testing done by a spacecraft on Mars. In order to confirm any evidence of microscopic life dating back billions of years when water flowed on the planet, it will take extensive examination at labs back on Earth, according to NASA. Using this information, it will determine where astronauts should land when they travel there for the proposed trip in 2040. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, has spearheaded the sample project. However, it experienced substantial downsizing earlier this year due to budget cuts. Nelson is soliciting ideas from across the space agency with the restructured program aimed at being more decentralized. So in other words, he's not looking for just one center of the space agency to work on it. He's kind of spreading it out. See who can work on what and then bring it all together into one program using other areas of the space agency. But NASA hopes to receive the proposals by fall of this year. So Marcus, start working on your proposal. See what you can do.
It sounds to me like they could use the services of Fry, Leela, and the gang there on Futurama, the courier service. That's all I could think of as you were reading the story.
Just go there, pick up the sample, come back home. Yeah. You know,
sorry for the obscure cartoon reference for anyone who didn't watch the show.
If you are curious, in that show, the spaceship didn't move. The spaceship moved space around it. Just to be clear, that's how they traveled in Futurama.
Thank you for clearing that up, Reggie. Everybody was wondering.
Just wanted to get that science out there.
That's science.
There's a whole episode about it. We talked about the solar car last week, so it seems fitting that for this day in history, we look at the first solar cell. On April 25th, 1954, scientists at Bell Laboratories unveiled the first modern solar cell using a silicon semiconductor to convert light into electricity. They had the cell power a 21-inch Ferris wheel. The next day, they ran a solar-powered radio transmitter, which broadcast voice and music to some of the top scientists that were in Washington, D.C. for a meeting. That is when the press took notice. The New York Times said, quote, "The silicon strips may provide more power than all the world's coal, oil, and uranium. Engineers are dreaming of silicon strip powerhouses," end quote. They added that this, quote, "may mark the beginning of a new era, leading eventually to the realization of one of mankind's most cherished dreams, the harnessing of the almost limitless energy of the sun for the uses of civilization," end quote. Obviously, I don't think we're quite to that level yet that the New York Times is reporting in 1954, but who knows where we'll be here in the future, I guess. So from the late 1800s on, there have been studies and tests done on harnessing the power of the sun, including some research from Einstein. However, it was in the early 1950s that R.S. Ohl had discovered that sunlight striking a wafer of silicon would produce unexpectedly large number of free electrons. In 1954, G.L. Pearson, C.S. Fuller, and D.M. Chapin created an array of several strips of silicon, each about the size of a razor blade, placed them in the sunlight, captured the free electrons, and turned them into an electrical current. This was the first solar battery. Now, it only converted 6% of sunlight into useful energy. And at that time, of course, many wondered what was that good for. Today, solar cells are in calculators, you know, highway emergency phones, satellites, and can convert 25% of the sunlight that hits them into useful energy.
Yeah, it doesn't shock me that people at the time were wondering what is this good for, but I think that's the vision that scientists have to say, it may not be good for all that much right now, but it's a first step. You have to realize that this is a progression. Things evolve with time. They advance with time and research. And oftentimes the original discovery or the original invention won't be worth all that much. But I had no idea the first solar cell came out all the way back in 1954. So I'm not sure if it's a bad thing that we're not a bit more advanced in that regard. But of course, there are a lot of things that go into the why of that whole question. We won't go down that road, but certainly seems kind of, as you alluded to earlier, Reg, we've made a lot of progress. And like everyone else, I'm curious to see where we'll be in another two decades, which we so often like to say on this show.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we're not to the point where New York Times wanted us to be, where we're basically harnessing the limitless energy of the sun for our civilization. But who knows, maybe someday, you never know, we might get there. And of course, you know, they also mentioned, you know, replacing coal, oil, and uranium. We're obviously not to that point yet.
No, clearly not. Again, though, a lot of things that go into that. And I have to believe in the 1950s, especially, just conceiving of the idea in which everything is powered exclusively off the sun had to have been a pretty wild thought. Even today, it's a pretty crazy thought.
Thanks for joining us on another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. If you have any comments or thoughts, reach us at coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. Also, like us and leave a review at Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I'm Reggie Rizzou. He's Marcus Path. We'll be back with more cool stuff tomorrow.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.